Have you been hitting the books and listening to lectures all day? It's time to relax, to unwind, and listen up. This is Brooke from Campus Chronicles, your go-to podcast for everything student life. No matter where you are in your academic journey, we have you covered. Think of us as a trusted mentor, friend, and confidant who always has your back. We'll be sharing inspiring stories, thought-provoking insights, and practical advice to help you succeed in and out of the classroom. So get ready to be inspired, enlightened, and entertained. Hello, hello, everyone. I am excited for what is going to be a serious and insightful and very important discussion. Today, we have Henry from CONCAC Self-Defense. Henry, thank you so much for being here. We are so excited to dive into this topic. But before we discuss personal safety, self-defense, and how incredibly important it is to be aware and be alert of our surroundings, we want to know, give us your background, your origin story, and where you got into self-defense and personal safety in the first place.
Background in terms of my interest in self-defense and martial arts. As a kid, I always thought martial arts was really cool. For example, I grew up watching movies like The Karate Kid with, you know, Daniel-san and Mr. Miyagi. I watched movies like Bloodsport starring Jean-Claude Van Damme about the illegal full contact martial arts tournament in Hong Kong. And so I always thought martial arts was really cool. My first exposure to actually practicing martial arts came when I joined the Tai Chi Club when I was an exchange student in Hong Kong. And later on in life, I dabbled a little bit in karate and aikido before I discovered World War II era military combatives. And since then, that's what I've been focused on is military style combatives as taught to elite units like Army Special Forces, the Marines, the CIA, stuff like that.
That's incredible. So that's very, very high level stuff. But when we think of personal safety, I think that so many people are nervous or intimidated or even a little bit scared to dip their toes into that. What is your opinion / definition of why self-defense and personal safety is important for everyone?
Well, the reality is that sadly, violent crime happens all around us. And there's a saying in the self-defense community, when seconds count, the police are minutes away. So it's up to each individual to take responsibility for their own safety. In fact, there was a court case, I don't remember the title, but the full name, but there was a court case where the court ruled that police officers do not have a responsibility to protect individual citizens. Their responsibility is to enforce the law and catch criminals, but not necessarily to protect a specific individual citizen. So it's up to each and every one of us to take responsibility for our own safety by learning and applying basic principles about how to stay safe and to protect ourselves.
When we think of our demographic that we're talking to university students. And all of us want to believe that our universities are safe, and for the most part, they probably are. However, there could be a circumstance where personal safety and self-defense becomes incredibly important. What would you say to university students who are a little nervous to get started with this?
If they're nervous about learning about the actual fighting techniques, that's one thing. But self-defense itself is not only fighting. Fighting is what you do when everything else on the spectrum of self-defense options has already failed. There's a line I read in a book, I think it was Meditations on Violence by Rory Miller. He's a sergeant, a corrections officer. And there was a line something like, it is better to avoid than to run, better to run than to de-escalate, better to de-escalate than to fight, but it is better to fight than to die. So there's a lot of different options, right? And so if you're nervous about learning how to fight, there are other options you can explore and start training yourself in that will help you protect yourself without actually fighting. Like, how do you spot trouble before it happens? How do you avoid dangerous situations and dangerous places and avoid going to bad places at bad times when bad things are likely to happen? That's all stuff that you can do without ever stepping foot in a boxing gym.
Can you give us an example of what some of those techniques look like?
So, for example, let's say you're in a crowd or at a party. Everyone's laughing and smiling and having a good time. But there's one guy who's not laughing and smiling. He's got a really dour, serious look on his face. That's the person you need to pay a little more attention to. Because if violence does happen, it would more likely happen from that person who doesn't fit in. In fact, in the book Left of Bang, How the Marine Corps Combat Hunter Program Can Save Your Life, it talks about combat profiling and talks about watching the environment and observing people's body language to look for anomalies. Look for what does not fit the normal baseline for what should be normal in that situation and that time and place. And because it's the stuff that does not fit the normal pattern that may lead to violence. It's not a guarantee that it'll lead to violence, but those are things that you need to watch more closely because it may lead to violence. I mean, I was at a party one time where that actually kind of happened. Like, everyone's laughing and smiling, but there was one guy at the party who kind of had a dour, unhappy expression on his face. He never got violent. He never even shouted at anyone. So it's not a guarantee that the person who doesn't fit in will get violent, but that's the person you need to watch a little more carefully because there's a high likelihood that if violence happens, it would come from that individual and not from someone who fits in the profile. For example, when there was a Boston Marathon bombing, when the police were watching surveillance video of it to try and figure out what happened, everyone's running and screaming. They're all panicking because, hey, a bomb just went off, right? I'd be freaking out too. But there were two guys in the video who were walking very calmly, totally in control. Turns out those two were the bombers. They knew what was happening because they were the ones who planned the bomb, right? They were the ones who did not fit the baseline. So things like that, just by paying attention and using your head, you can avoid a lot of trouble.
If you're somebody who, like myself, I struggle a little bit with awareness. If you're somebody who's not naturally super intuitive and aware, how can you train yourself to become more aware of what you're talking about in terms of looking for those who don't fit the baseline like you're discussing?
There are a few tricks to just, in general, keep yourself more aware of your environment. One thing you do is, well, as you're walking around town, count in your head, how many people do you see wearing glasses? Because that forces you to look around at people, right? One book I read mentions, look for beautiful things, right? Like, if you're a guy, look, you know, see how many pretty girls can you spot in the crowd? Because it forces you to look around, pay attention to what's around you. And especially, you want to pay attention at transitions. For example, when you're, after you've parked your car at the mall and you're about to get out, before you open the door and get out, glance around. You've got mirrors so you can look all around. So glance around, see who's around you, what vehicles and what people are around you, right? Things like that. When you're about to go through a doorway, before you step through that doorway, take a moment to look at what's beyond. Is there anyone or anything that doesn't fit the baseline? Is there anyone or anything that might indicate possible danger?
How do you think cell phones and technology poses a risk to our security and our personal safety?
Well, the most obvious thing is that a lot of times people are walking around like this, moving more too much attention to their cell phone and not looking around them. I've seen that in a lot of times. And I know that especially happens with a lot of younger people because young people tend to be early adopters of new technology. So that's a habit that people need to break right away. Beyond that, cell phones can be used to track you, right? It's got a GPS. It's communicating with cell towers. So bad guys with the right software could track your phone and your location.
When we think of awareness of our surroundings and sort of the things that you're discussing, I can think of many times myself where I have been convicted of, absolutely, I've been talking on my cell phone, perhaps I've been texting on my cell phone, and paying little to no attention to my surroundings. And that's dangerous, obviously, for a number of reasons. But let's say you've done the first step, you're willing to be more aware of your surroundings. What is the next step that you can teach yourself?
If you do spot something potentially hazardous, you need to be decisive about what you're going to do. In the book that I discussed, Left of Bang, about the Marine Corps Combat Hunter Program, it talks about the common rule of three. If you see three clear indicators of something that does not fit the baseline, you must decide either get away, hide, be prepared to fight, or report it to a security officer or a police officer or something. But do something. That's the threshold of decision. Once you see three clear indicators, you must decide on doing something. One or two indicators may be enough if it's a clear enough indicator. But once it gets up to three indicators, You must decide. And that's the basic rule that they teach in the Marine Corps Combat Hunter program.
And I think that a lot of times we might question our own decisions and we may question what we want to do in that moment. How do you learn how to make a quick, streamlined decision if you do feel that you're in danger?
I would say listen to your instincts. In the book, The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker, he talks about how a lot of crime victims prior to the attack report that they had a bad feeling. So if something or someone just doesn't feel right for whatever reason, avoid and get away, get to safety. Now, admittedly, your instinct about the risk of danger may be wrong. Maybe there's no threat there. But what if you're right? Isn't it better to err on the side of caution?
Mm-hmm. So I'm taking in so much from you. So we make a decision, obviously report to someone. We, you know, make the decision to leave, whatever that decision is. If we find ourselves in a situation where we're isolated, what do we do in that case? Because we may be isolated in a dorm room or somewhere else, in a car or something of that nature. What is your best advice for those isolated situations?
Are you assuming that the attacker is already there and initiating an attack?
Maybe you're noticing strange behavior from someone that you're in an isolated situation with.
In that case, I would get away as fast as you can. If it just doesn't feel right, say, you can make an excuse, say, like, pat the pocket where you keep your phone and say, oh, sorry, I think it's my mom calling. I got to go out and take this, and then just use that excuse to get away, right? Stuff like that.
So anything that you can do to, leave the situation.
Yeah, do what you can, leave the situation. Or, for example, if you're waiting for an elevator, right? The door is open, and you see someone kind of sketchy in the elevator, don't get in the elevator with them, right? You can make an excuse saying, oh, hey, I'm waiting for my friend. I'll catch the next elevator car. And, you know, I mean, really, there may be no danger there and that the person is actually harmless. But again, better to err on the side of caution.
It is. Now, you mentioned the word de-escalation. Let's dive into that a little bit because that's a really powerful technique. What is de-escalation? We'll begin there. And then how do you learn and practice it secondly?
So, for example, let's say angry words are starting to be exchanged. And the other person is obviously, their heat level is rising, they're getting angrier. So at that point, but violence has not broken out yet. And maybe you can de-escalate it so violence does not occur, right? So the best thing is to talk to them in a very calm, respectful tone and say, hey, I'm sorry you feel that way. I felt that way too. Here's what I've found, right? That feel, felt, found approach has an empathic connection with the person to try and help calm down and tone things down. And if they are potentially getting closer to violence, but you can still talk them down, it's best to put up your hands in a placating gesture like this. This is called the fence pose, right? This body language clearly communicates that you don't want trouble. But it also puts your hands up and between you and the other person so that if there is something that happens, your hands are up and ready that you can defend yourself. You can block or you can strike or whatever you need to do.
As you're talking about this and de-escalation, something that's coming to mind is romantic relationships. And obviously romantic relationships in university, we're exploring, we're dating different people and oftentimes being in exclusive relationships with people. And there is a significant threat of violence within romantic relationships. What is your advice for de-escalation in those situations and awareness in those situations?
The first thing I would say is avoidance. If there are signs early on that the other person could become possessive or harassing or violent, then it's time to break off the relationship and get away as fast as you can. And there usually will be some sort of warning signs. For example, if they're too interested in you too soon, if they're calling you every day when you've just met, that sort of thing. If they're asking you, hey, who you were at this time last night, stuff like that. They're too intrusive too soon in the relationship. That's a clue that this person can't let go and you should just remove yourself from that relationship.
And another thing I would add to that is combativeness. If you can't have a conversation without someone becoming combative, that is a real warning sign.
Another thing is if it's time to break off the relationship, the way to do it is to break it off. For example, if they call you 20 times and you finally get fed up and you call them back and say, hey, don't call anymore, all that's telling them is that all they do is call you 20 times and they'll get contact with you, right? So just break it off.
Right. It's rewarding them for the behavior. And then when we think about platonic or friendship relationships, they can also become very toxic and potentially dangerous as well. But it's, again, similarly hard to break those off.
Yeah. If it gets further than that, for example, there was this one story. This story again comes from the book The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker. It talks about how there was a woman who was being physically abused by her husband. And so she comes into the police station one day to report it. But she doesn't want to leave him yet. She just wants to report it to police officers. So the sergeant taking her report says, okay, you fill this out. You fill this out, and I'll put it right here in my file box. And the next year, you know, since you're not willing to leave your husband, even though he's abusing you. And the next time I reach for this form, it will be because the cops responded to 911 call because your husband murdered you. He was making the point to her, you know, don't just file a report. You know, if he's abusing you, leave, right? And it can be hard. You know, sometimes it can be hard because abusers can have a lot of not only physical control over their victim, but a lot of psychological control over the victim. But if you want to preserve your own safety, it is important to leave that abusive relationship.
It is. It is. And when we think about stalking, harassment, and cyber harassment, which cyber harassment is obviously newer and becoming of increased prevalence, how does cyber harassment, other forms of harassment, and stalking fit into this puzzle?
You know, I don't know that much about cyber harassment, so I'm not really qualified to speak about that. Other than to say that it's just another avenue that people can try and get to you. And so just block their account, you know, delete your social media and start a new one with a new name and tell your close friends and them, like, here's my new account. Actually, here's what's even better. If someone's harassing or stalking you either by phone or by cyber social media, leave that phone number or that account up, but establish a new account and tell only your trusted friends and family about the new account. So the harasser just sends stuff to the old account. You can monitor it to see if it gets threatening and to report to the police, but he or she doesn't know about your new account. So your new account is clean and safe for your friends and family who you want contact with.
Mm-hmm. And if somebody is physically stalking, what is your advice there?
So let's say you're out and about town and you notice someone's following you. So the best thing to do is go somewhere public where there's a lot of witnesses and probably like security officers, or go to the nearest police station.
That's very important advice. A lot of times our fight or our flight kicks in and it can be very, very hard to make decisions because we're flooded with stress hormones. How do you mitigate that response so that you're able to think clearly?
So some of that response is actually useful because the increased adrenaline makes you stronger and faster. So if you need to run, you can run faster. If you need to fight, you can hit harder. But in terms of calming yourself down to keep it under control, there's a technique called box breathing. It's also called combat breathing because this is taught to soldiers to help them stay calm in dangerous situations. You breathe in deeply as you count to four. And when you take your breath in, it should be belly breathing, where if you put your hand on your belly, you can feel your belly expand like a balloon. That tells you that you're using your full diaphragm to get a deep breath. After that, you hold that breath to a count of four, and you breathe out to a count of four, and you hold for a four count again. That four, 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 that's a full box. So that's one cycle of box breathing. If you do that a few times, that should help you calm down enough that you can start thinking things through and thinking clearly.
Okay, so that is a good. And then to your point, the adrenaline does kick in if you need to, as you said, physically flee, whatever that is. But in situations where we may want to de-escalate, we're probably going to use that box breathing technique to keep ourselves calm, regulated as best we can, and in control. So when we think about self-defense and personal safety, there's often a stigma that it is only for women. What would you say to people who feel that way?
You know, men get attacked too. Oftentimes men start the problem because they get in a heated argument because guys tend to be macho, they have egos, they posture, and so they exchange harsh words, and sometimes that it escalates to a fist fight. So men get involved in violent altercations just as much as women do. So men need self-defense too. I admittedly, women, if I was a bad guy and I had the choice between attacking a man or a woman to either get money or whatever, I would attack the woman because, you know, just basic biology is working against a woman because on average, women tend to have less muscle strength and especially in their upper body than men do. Now, that's on average, not all cases. I mean, there are a lot of female athletes who I'm sure could kick my butt if they wanted to. But on average, women will have tend to have less upper body strength. So knowing that, a woman needs to compensate by training hard in self-defense and also doing a little weightlifting or strength training to compensate for the fact that biology was working against her. I remember in the past, I trained an old gentleman. He was about in his 60s or so, I would guess, in self-defense. And about the same time, I also trained two young ladies. They were, I think they were 20s in self-defense. And even though the young ladies were much younger and healthier than the older gentleman, I could feel that the man could hit a lot harder than these two young ladies could. He was hitting a lot harder. So, I mean, there's that working against you. Now, one way you can compensate that also is that by focusing on kicking techniques, because for leg strength, the disparity between muscle strength between men and women is less pronounced. So it's more advantageous for women to especially learn how to use her legs to defend herself by kicking or using knee strikes.
That's really interesting because I've always heard about the upper body and the just significant and massive disparity between upper body strength and males and females. And to your point about both genders and on all genders needing personal safety and self-defense, I think it is so incredibly important. When we think about personal safety, which is a bigger scope than self-defense, and some of these techniques that we can use to keep ourselves safe in a world that feels increasingly unsafe, is there any other strategies or techniques that you recommend? Just as we see, unfortunately, violence start to become more pronounced across many parts of the world.
Well, here's a few things that when I give a seminar on self-defense that I always emphasize. Pay attention and use your head, right? Prepare in advance. For example, when I talk about kidnapping, I tell people prepare in advance so that if you get kidnapped, there's fallback options. For example, what you can do to prepare for kidnapping, you can take a lock of hair, a DNA sample, have a set of fingerprints, and a recent photo of yourself. Give this to your friends and family. If you get kidnapped, they can hand it to the police and it assists the police in their investigation so they can find you. You can also prepare a duress code as an innocuous phrase, something that seems harmless, but if you speak it to your friend or family member, they know, aha, that's the code phrase. Brooke is in trouble. I need to call 911 and have the cops go look for her because she's in trouble. Also, if you are kidnapped, try and leave DNA traces because if you prepare in advance, then the police have your lock of hair to try trace DNA, right? So you can like make a small cut on your finger, leave a little blood on the table, leave some skin samples or pull out some of your hair and leave it somewhere. You want to leave somewhere where the bad guys won't clean it up, but it's somewhere the police can find if they're searching the area. So if you're moved and the police find that location, they find your DNA, they match it, they say, aha, we're on the right track. Whenever it's legal, you know, don't do anything illegal here, but whenever it's legal, carry a weapon if you are prepared to use it. If you carry a weapon that you're not willing to use, you're just bringing a weapon to the fight that the bad guy can take away and use against you. So you have to be prepared to use the weapon. And it doesn't have to be a gun. I mean, most people, it's hard to get a concealed carry license for a firearm, but there are other weapons you can carry. For example, a Kubaton, a tactical pen, pepper spray, a stun gun. In a lot of, some places, some of these are legal, but in most places, most of those are legal to carry. Know how to use an improvised weapon. Know how to pick up a trash can lid and use it to lock a knife or jam into someone's throat. You can pick up a beer mug and smash it against someone's face, right? You can be creative as you want in improvising a weapon, right? Things like that.
If you are going to speak to university-age students and give them three pieces of advice different than what we've shared already, what would those three unique pieces of advice be?
I guess one thing would be choose your friends carefully. Not only because what if they might be someone who would harm you, but you also want friends who that if you're drunk at a party, your friends will say, hey, you've had too much. We're taking you home. And they will drag you out of there and make sure you get home safely, right? Those are the kinds of friends you want. You don't want the friend who's the life of the party. You want your friend to be the one who makes sure the life of the party gets home safely.
That's so important.
I guess in general for university students, this is not related to self-defense, but make the most of your time as a university student. Like, you know, study hard, do things that will help prepare you to launch your professional career. Because in a lot of cases, where you go to school is actually not as important as what you do while you're in school. For example, if you go to Harvard, Yale, but you flunk out, that doesn't really help you so much. But if you go to, say, UCLA or Cal State LA, but you totally kick butt as a student there and do great in classes, you're involved in professional societies and you get internships in your field, that will help you launch your professional career.
Mm-hmm. And so have fun, study hard, and be safe is what Henry would say to everybody. As we wrap up here, if people are really inspired by your message, where can they find you and connect with you?
I can say my old business is called Commando Combatives and Calculus. So that website is up. It's the full name, CommandoCombativesandCalculus.com. That has both information about my tutoring services, because I'm also a prime tutor, and about self-defense. So if you go to that website, even though it's old, it has all the information I can present about self-defense services. Or they can email me at combatcalc, C-O-M-B-A-T-C-A-L-C, at yahoo.com.
Thank you so much for sharing all of your energy and your insights. Although it's a little bit of a challenging topic, it can be a little troubling. We are so grateful that you took the time and the space and the energy to share with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining me on Campus Chronicles. I hope you found our discussion informative, inspiring, entertaining, and fun. We are always working hard to make sure that our episodes are the very best they can be, which means we need your help. If you liked what you heard, remember to hit the follow button on your favorite podcast platform and drop us a review. It helps us to connect with more students who are hungry for success. And remember, the journey never stops. Keep listening, keep learning, keep growing. See you next week for another amazing episode of Campus Chronicles.